new area that we are now discussing of global microhistory. And I've been involved with John Paul Gobriel in we set up this network. We got a grant to do these conferences and salon on this topic. From my perspective, I've been doing global history for a long time, and I was getting really fed up with the directions it was taking, full of big data sets and people making huge claims and, you know, census comparisons, etc. And getting a sense that there were a lot of people who wanted to take part in global history, but they wanted to be close to individual accounts, to working in their archives, to but yet connecting what they were doing to wider frameworks of global history and the kinds of questions it raised, etc. But there was this tradition of microhistory that looked really interesting, but it was something that was really done in the late 1970s through the 1980s. But people are still really interested and fascinated by the work that was done then. Was there a way of bringing these two together? Certainly the microhistorians, they wrote that what they were doing was something that was very particular, focused on individual experiences. They wrote in concepts of the exceptional, normal, etc. Many of their archives were based in court records, the records of the Inquisition, etc. How do we use this kind of approach, this methodology? They were very keen on the text, on individual writing, etc. But my problem with a lot of this work is that our history has changed in the period since that traditional microhistory had begun. Now, we include material culture. We include the study of objects in how we present our work. We include the use of archaeology, of maps, etc. So, can we do a kind of microhistory that involves these quite different types of sources than microhistorians of the 1980s type had used? I mean, they trolled wonderful stories out of this work. Can we tell those kinds of stories engaging with archaeology, with the study, this close, intense study of the objects? So that's a sort of general introduction to some of the directions we're trying to take with discussing whether there's any possibility of bringing global history together with microhistory and moving towards a form of global microhistory. We hope so, or otherwise we're left with something that's an oxymoron and we don't, you know, maybe it's not going to work. But I think it's a very exciting time where we can discuss these possibilities. So we're hoping for lots of intervention, from discussion, from various parts, and we have people coming through the galleries who are not part of this particular group, but they are welcome to join in our discussions. And it's very much part of the project of the salon. Okay, I'm just going to stop there.
My very now dated experience of being at our RCA, it's gone on a long way since I did it.
And I'm going to ask you to speak up.
Just here. That was the point in the first midterm essay, which I'm sure you still do, where you can choose one object in the museum and you write basically 10,000 words. But there you take a micro history of an object, and the very best case scenario is where a global story is told through that one object. So in a sense, that's a discipline that has been encouraging the connection between the micro and the global. It doesn't always work, we know that, but actually that's one of the foundations of the course. whose auspices we're here today. So, you know, there is, and that's been, I don't know how that has shifted over the 20 odd years since I did the course, and how it has changed to adopt these new ideas. Just a comment, rather than a historian using objects, it's object based material culture is doing history. I mean, is there a difference?
As a representative, of course, and I'm bringing a DC who's actually done the
course. Great, if you could just say your name.
My name's Mike Sweeting. So I teach at the B&A RCA History Design course, and we still do this early essay, which is about single objects in collection. It's not 10,000 words anymore, it's 6,000 words now. But we do encourage that discipline, and I'm going to ask Aditi to speak about it in a minute, because she did one last year on a project that's luckily here. I think one of the problems with that is that when you're encountering objects, and especially when you're trying to get into the world of manufacturers, people that make stuff don't write those thick histories, or they don't get caught up in the kind of documentary web that allows those Italian micro-histories to take place. You don't get that sense of narrative. I think that's one of the key things from one of the texts, that you get accounts, you get very different forms of writing that you have to work with to piece together. And that is a bit of a barrier sometimes. From the consumption side, I think it's easier. You do get people narrating objects and thinking about use and buying in a slightly different way that allows you to make that kind of quite rich, qualitative story. But I think from a manufacturing side, it's tricky. Anyway.
Yeah,
could you say your name, please?
My name's Aditi Khare. So for my first object essay, I did an embroidered piece manufactured in Gujarat and India, and then was sold in Britain or, well, Europe, we don't know exactly where. I ended up in Britain. And I did it from the producer's side and from the trader, so the broker and the merchant side. And it's like I said, it was actually... My idea of it turned out to be that it was one of the failed pieces, because you could see a lot of different influences on the design, which obviously would not have been the craftsman making it, because it would be a commissioned piece. But you could see where they just stopped halfway through and then changed to a different style. And it was in a sense a micro-history, because you could see the process it had gone through in the making of it, even though it was commissioned. But as soon as you move out of that little kind of zoomed in view, you immediately see the brokers and the merchants and the East India Company men who would really not be concerned with the design of the pieces. It was it didn't work. It failed.
Yes.
And so, yeah, but then that's an example of a failure as an exception translating to a bigger, I guess you could say, a globalist event.
That's an interesting take. Avalon Fotheringham. I'm the curator of the South Asian textile collection here at the B&A. And one of the things that's most fascinating about the piece that Aditi worked on is that it reflects the popularity of bazaar silks in France and their translation into Gujarati embroidery, which has already had, at the point this was made, a long tradition of making things to spec. They're not being done with the imagery that would have been traditional to that region. They're being done according to the designs that are being ordered, and that is in place from the very beginning. And what we saw in the chintz earlier is the same. You find the same patterns worked in chintz down on the Coromandel Coast, worked in embroidery in Gujarat at the same time. So we can see that these designs are coming from Europe, being worked in India, being sold back to Europeans as exotic luxuries of India, as completely strange and new and brilliant designs that are completely non-native to Europe, despite being designed by Europeans. And then, as they fail and fashions change, new designs come from these regions, which are sold again as being just as exotic as those initial failed ones. So it's all kind of a farce in that sense, where we're being sold on the exotic that doesn't actually exist, but is just as subjective to fashion in Europe as it is things that are coming directly from those regions as representations of the actual art and design of those places.
We've heard from three people at the V&A. Say your name, please.
So I'm Callie Wilkinson, and I'm a history postdoc at Warwick. And on the one hand, I was thinking that microhistory, as it was practiced in Italy, was so closely linked to anthropology, and this object-based history that we're talking about also seems, again, to sort of promise that same interdisciplinarity by linking up with an anthropology of things and telling the biographies of objects. But then that also made me wonder if we're telling the if we're moving from telling the biographies of people to telling the biographies of objects, how does that respond to the provocations in Jeremy Adelman's essay if we're simply using objects rather than people to speak to cosmopolitanism and connections? So is there a way that objects can also be used to speak to disjunctures and disconnections as opposed to sort of creating this vision of a cosmopolitan, stylish, global society?
Yes, so I'm Elsje van Gessel, History of Art at St. Andrews. Just to respond to that, I think that's really important. And I think in art history now, and there's this global turn there, of course, too. And I think there's still quite a lot of emphasis on this peaceful and harmonious and how objects, you know, incorporate all these different elements from different cultures. So what I personally try to do in my project right now is to look at stealing, at looting, at smuggling, and all of these practices around objects that involve conflict and are the result of war and other, you know, more problematic practices. I think that's really important. I think I find that Edelman types, I found it resonated with me a lot.
There was also a very interesting HERA project that finished last year, I think it was, that was called Marrying Cultures, and it was about queens consort in early modern Europe, and that was very interesting about the disjunctures and the tensions that you have when a consort arrives to marry a ruler of whichever, you know, of a different country, brings with her her own cultures and her own material culture, and what that role, the role of that, and often a very disruptive and quite often problematic role within in relation to her role in her new role as the consort and supposedly assimilating within her the new context. Sorry, that's very gold. But it's those, I think, are, that's obviously at a very elite level, but it is definitely objects playing a role in terms of disruption.
I'm George Uriello from the University of Warwick, and I gather it is a problem whether we are substituting objects for people within a similar kind of framework and then seeing this kind of harmonious coming together different things. But there is another aspect to it. You could see the other side of the coin in many ways, in thinking that we are disrupting traditional categories, kind of neat boxes that wants us to place certain people as well as certain objects in certain categories that are never neutral. They tend to be constructed mostly from inherited classifications that come from Europe. Quite a lot of them come either from the Renaissance or the Enlightenment. And in a sense, once we do these processes, both in terms of microhistory in the Italian way or the kind of micro-approach object-based, we are actually unraveling those categories. We are critiquing them, and we are constructing them in a much more flexible way. So you might say that a lot of them seems to be kind of cosmopolitan and nice, but actually at the basis of it, I think there is actually a big project of disruption, of reclassification that is incredibly important. And this gallery is actually the result of that. It couldn't have been done in the 1970s, and it's done now. And it's a gallery that is much more inclusive. So it's still a gallery in Europe without Britain. It's a gallery that really performs a very different function to anything that was done from the previous gallery that tend to be incredibly conservative and really about, you know, goes about the decorative arts as done in a very British way and so on. So there is the other side of it.
Yes, we do.
Sudha from the University of Warwick as well. Following up from both of these points, it made me think of the seminar that we had at Warwick a couple of weeks ago, where we had the director and one of the curators of the Foundling Museum speaking about these emotive objects. And I think that that is something that helps perhaps bring these perspectives of the disconnections more than what we see in this kind of gallery. So in a gallery like this, where we still see beautiful objects, we don't see slave shackles, for instance. So those kind of objects that are really the sort of powerful material remains of a very painful history of disconnections or connections that lead to destruction. You do have some museums where you have more prominent places for those kind of objects, and I think that can really help tell these global histories of the dark side as well.
Could I just intervene here? I'm Maxine Berg, University of Warwick. I think that Kelly raised a really interesting question about these traditions of microhistory and the way of the stories, the narrative that's so central to it. I want to go back to that problem of if we can have more discussion of the way we can connect the study of objects into this kind of approach, this kind of history. There's a question that Jean-Paul Gabriel is always telling us about the significance of philology. So we can think about philology, but let's also think about the way that we analyze these objects and set them into our wider frameworks of history. And I always ask the question to him, are signatures really better than shards? And so the issue I want to raise is not, I don't think the way forward is really turning objects into some kind of action-based history, or we have people who talk about thing theory, or there's these strange approaches which are now emerging, which I don't understand, because I have always thought about the objects that I have seen as both products, creations of technologies, and as consumer goods or possessions, objects in collections, as an interaction with the people who made them, the people who bought them, who suggested designs for them, etc. So I think we really have to keep that connection of the object and those individuals, the people that we want to study in history, to keep those connections close. But as I think again the point that Callie has made, it's not a story, a simple story of cosmopolitanism, that there are deep histories of disruption, of exploitation, of work processes, etc., that we need to uncover with all of this. So I think taking a special look at something like that steel fireplace and thinking about a factory in Russia that was making this and using those Birmingham styles and techniques, etc., and trying to find out more, it leads us into trying to find out more about this workforce that has been transformed from armorers to producers of strange steel fireplaces. So, yes.
Helen Clifford,
yes.
Just because I've been speaking briefly to Spike Sweeting about this project, which I think which could relate to that, which was about Spike.
Energy consumption.
Yeah, Spike, tell us.
So I was remarking, not necessarily on the style of this amazing steel fireplace, which was, as you say, completely Birmingham, kind of mid-1770s, all of that polished steel, which becomes amazingly fashionable, especially on small items. What's kind of remarkable about that is that is steel on a huge scale, made presumably using charcoal burning techniques, which are infinitely more expensive and ecologically devastating for the region where that's going on than what's going in Birmingham. And so I think you're getting quite different histories, potentially, between the two. Even though there is a big stylistic link, you can kind of drill down into workforces in a quite different way if you're thinking in that kind of very, I guess, protean way of approaching these things. It's like beyond the visual content.
It's sorry, Joe Norman, DNA. It's from a. I would absolutely agree, and I would say from the museum's perspective, certainly when we were working on these galleries, and I think actually increasingly as we move on to plan other gallery projects, for example, in the 19th century, that is where people have more information about it. I think the histories of work, the involvement, and the impact of the manufacturing process and how that works, what is embedded in each object is driven like about that is something that we're certainly very interested in. Often there is the challenge of what evidence there is to actually find out more about that. But also there's if you're looking at it within a context like this, there's a challenge in how you actually can display that. Because the amount of interpretation we have is limited, and so you know we always have to make. We said quite rightly at the beginning, Helen, that each of these things could be displayed in myriad ways. You could use the banyan to tell a very different story. You could use that tapestry over there to tell a very different story from the one that it shows at the moment. But you have to make decisions. We as curators make decisions about how those things are displayed. And I think it's something that we're talking about a lot increasingly as digital means provide, in theory at least, other ways of exploring other narratives in a way that perhaps is not just loading loads more text into the galleries, but actually can enable us to uncover some of those things a bit more.
I think one of the major challenges in discussing manufacturing processes is often the only way that you can determine anything about how it was made is by looking at the reverse or the underside of the object. So in order to display something like that, you essentially have to ignore the part that was meant to be seen and put it in such a way that you're just sort of looking at the bit that you have to be a specialist to understand in many cases. So it becomes very, very difficult to offer that kind of interpretation. Even when it gives a lot of insight into the people who are making the things. In the case of embroideries like those from Gujarat, recent analysis of them has determined that they were made with straight needles and not hooked needles, which means it was infinitely more difficult. Yeah. But the only way that you can show that is to show the back of the embroidery, which is not quite as beautiful, and then to explain the difference between those two things, which means you don't have any space left on the label to talk about what it is or
why. Mehakriyadarshini, University of Edinburgh. I wonder, talking about evidence and sort of these issues, if we could go back to the microhistorians of the 1980s, the Italian school. One of the things that I think that they did really well was question their evidence, because of course they had to think about their trial records and they were written in a particular way to say a particular story, and that's not the story they wanted to tell. So they had to read between the lines, and in their narrative, they would say, this is what I've done with these sources. That became, Ginsburg is very much about making it known, his process known. And something that happens when we work with objects is this conversation that we've had today is not in the final product when we write about these objects. And I think it would be really helpful to put this in that final product, to say that there are limits to what we can do with these objects. Someone thinks this looks geometric and Hispano-Moresque, and someone thinks it looks this way, and we don't know. And these are the tools we use to get to some consensus. And then this also is helpful because working with objects is different than telling the story of people, so that the audience gets a sense of, or the difference of working with objects, that you're not just replacing, as you say very rightly, that you're not just putting in objects where there were people, because the kinds of histories we can write with objects are very different. And I think to an audience, it's not obvious. It's kind of, and when I started with working with objects, curators seemed like just, wow, just this wealth of knowledge. And then as I needed to know more, I realized there were limits. So that's something that's productive to put out.
I'm Joe Tierney, University of Warwick. I found that, so my training was history of design here at the V&A, and when I started my PhD, Giorgio was always pushing me to try and get in as much contact as possible with people who had no history of design knowledge or background whatsoever, having to try to explain to a room of very traditional economic historians why I was looking at objects and why I was considering things like custom records and trademark data, but paying so much attention to the textiles, I think really helped me to develop the framework of my research. But it also it is making it into the thesis, because I have begun to realise that that process is as important as what comes out at the end of it and the arguments that are made.
Right.
Yeah, I think it would be great to see more of that process as well.
Our time is advancing rapidly, and there's several we haven't heard from, so I just, now's your chance.
Perhaps, if I may, Toby Graff, University of Oxford. One of the things that you wrote about mixing a lot, also in the text, was emphasising practices, and I think that's one of the beauties of using objects, or thinking about objects, is because they can start, you know, they can prompt questions about the practices that underlay their creation, but also their transfer, the way that they modify them. And that actually is also true, just to defend John Ball, it's also true of texts. I mean, one of the things that we do within the project group a lot is think about what people usually think of as texts as actually material objects. So manuscripts have a history of being written, of being modified, of being annotated. And these allow you to tell exciting stories and ask interesting questions about how these objects were actually used in their later life.
It's a sort of material culture approach to the text.
Very much so, yes.
And if Cecilia Terwell from University of Oxford, and if I may add to this, because I'm working and also related to the same project, also the challenge of working about objects that we only can approach them through text, and we don't have objects anymore. Mm-hmm. And they are very poor objects. I work on people moving between Islamic and Christian lands, and what kind of objects they are carrying with them. And we only have a few hints here and there in text, and how do we deal with this? And what can they tell this object that we don't see anymore about these connections or disconnections?
And then it's quite interesting to see how they're actually described in the texts, because that also gives a certain perspective of how much detail is actually involved when someone sees this and puts this into a poetic record.
I was speaking about objects that are difficult to access or study or don't exist anymore. I am currently working on chemistry behind the calico printing techniques. And when it comes to chemistry, you can't pull apart the object to figure out what modern went into it, which is why then texts become your primary way of approaching it, because whoever did it maybe wrote something down on a piece of paper somewhere that you can find. Most probably didn't. And then it comes to the whole oral histories idea, is that if he didn't write it down, did he tell somebody who could have written it? And then you just go into a whole network of... That maybe is a way of analyzing smaller interactions to bigger stories really when you can't access the object.
Or the text. Kirsty has her BNA. I was also thinking of Avalon's comment about the value of unfinished objects. Mm-hmm. We've got some examples of waistcoat shapes that are in Gallery 3, and I was sort of thinking about the value of the process that's behind those objects, even though for whatever reason they're never really, there's a sort of like interruption in their process.
And they never fulfill their purpose.
Yeah, they never fulfill the purpose, and I was thinking that's such a fascinating thing that we have. In the collection.
Sorry, could you repeat the kind of objects again?
Unfinished objects.
Unfinished,
so,
yes.
Yeah, waistcoat shapes or yes. Samples that were never really turned into anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, were they left unfinished because nobody liked them?
Yeah.
Another failed object.
Yes.
Perhaps Toby, graphically. Just perhaps one thing, because we talked about the exceptional normal a number of times, at least the phrase has come up. And we've talked about some of the objects here, which you've always said were exceptional objects. It's not necessarily always obvious what is exceptional, right? Is it, sometimes you really need to find out how a certain object is exceptional. And that, of course, tells you a lot about the norm, about the kinds of objects that were produced, that people owned, and where they would be found.
I'm a little conscious of the time. When do they actually take us out, Jack?
Oh, I think it's found it. Oh, sorry.
So we can't have it. We won't carry on very long, because people have to get back. Yes, that's... I think that point is... it's really... this problem of how you identify which one is what is exceptional, what is the, and we have this concept that is brought through global microhistory of the exceptional normal. What does that mean, this concept by Graham? Can we do anything with the study of objects with this kind of concept? So I think it's a question that we could perhaps address in one of our future sessions. This particular session was meant to focus on trade and exchange. We're moving on into other topics in our next salon meetings. I think we have one on gifts and ambassadorial exchange. Yes, and then we have one on writing and...
Cultures of correspondence.
Sorry? Cultures of correspondence. There we are. There's something for John Paul to get his teeth into. I hope he can come to that meeting. Would somebody like to just perhaps sum up on what this... what we found out tonight about trade and exchange in this tour of the galleries.
I don't have a sum up to offer. I still have a question. So if someone else wants to sum up, perhaps I say it before having to do that. Shall I ask my question?
Yes.
So I think as someone who doesn't work with objects myself, but I'm interested in trying to think through the notion of the agency of the material, so the object as the actor. I always find myself struggling most when I need to explain this to students, because I can see how through consumption objects change how we live our daily lives. I can see in terms of the commodities that are substances, so the foodstuffs or the tobacco. I was just wondering, from the object expert, I figured I'll take a chance before we leave, to tell me who has done a life's object where really it's the object that is the moving actor in the story and not the people who invest the object with meanings.
I think what you're asking about is provenance, which is standard practice in curatorial work, is what we have to establish is the life of the object, not the individuals who owned it, but the number of hands it passed through, and as much as possible fill in the gaps between its creation and its arrival at the museum in order to establish a legal right of ownership. So we do that as a standard practice, in that we follow the object's life, and the people around it are sort of side characters, where we get to say ownership passed through these people, and therefore we can trace our legal right to have it. But the story of the object is paramount above anything else, particularly when it comes to issues like if the person who owned it before us, if their biography was related to any kind of conflict, would have led to them to have come by that object by illegal means, then how do we trace these sort of black holes of information about stages in that object's life? And what do we do when we can't fill those in? But that's provenance. That's provenance is an object's life as opposed to individuals' lives around the object.
And I suppose I see that, perhaps I'm just not conceptualizing it well. Perhaps I see that as sort of placing the camera position, sort of the GoPro on the top of the object, and then you follow the surroundings, but you see it through the object's eyes. I don't see that as the object changing the story around it so much.
Well, there I would disagree. I mean, especially in a diplomatic context, I mean, objects can very much define practices and influence the negotiations, you know, by influencing relationships between actors.
I think also in things like histories and technology, because if you're thinking about, I mean, we all use it, but the porcelain thing, the fact that it is the arrival of the porcelain rather than the technique, it's the, what the material is, as well as the design of it, that then influences our level of production, ceramic productions in Europe, which want to imitate it. So there is a real, and what's happening?
No.
That you know, you can look at that in certain in relation to certain object types. You can't necessarily look at it on an individual level.
I think I'm going to draw things to a close because people are going to be getting anxious about trains, etc. I want to thank everybody who came. There's going to be two further salon sessions, so keep in touch. We can't invite all of you to all of them again because we try to keep this a fairly small group for going around museums. But I think the great thing about a gathering like this is it's brought together people that I otherwise hadn't met, and some of my own institution. So this is really great. And we have curators at the V&A that many of you from the various universities have been able to engage with, and so it's a meeting point, a discussion group, and I hope that you will carry on these connections beyond just the occasional meeting that a network allows us to bring in the way that it allows us to bring you together. So I'd like to thank everybody, and especially Helen and Joanna, who have been here with us to offer expertise on the gallery. And I hope to see some of you at least next time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is that you? It would not have been.